Good morning. This is Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Hello, this is Ridgeway Magazine with me, John Shepherd, and Andy Venton. Now then, I invite you to take a deep breath and thank the Lord you're breathing in pure Dorset air. We start the programme with a virtual visit to the most polluted cities in the world, and by that I mean New Delhi, Beijing and Sao Paulo, and sample the air there, all in the course of creating awareness of the quality of air we take for granted. We hear the moon is landing at the North Fort. Well, we just had to find out more about that. And before we forget about D-Day, let us remember the injured service people in more recent conflicts. General Lord Dannett talks to Ridgeway Magazine about how he came to create the charity Help for Heroes.
Now, it is 100 days since the five Dorset councils became one unitary authority. There were lots of misgivings at the time, so we talk to the clerk of Weymouth Town Council and ask, have there been any changes? Now, here's a subject to set the cat among the pigeons. Oh dear. Do women in the home take up an awful lot more space than men? Yes, is the answer in a survey we share with you. And don't blame us, we didn't do the survey. And our gardening subject is roses. Not the easiest plant to grow, but we have some advice.
Now then, I've been, and I pause for a quick clearing of the throat, to three of the most polluted cities in the world: New Delhi, Sao Paulo and Beijing, and all without leaving Portland. No, this is no joke. I experienced the disgusting, eye-watering and disgraceful air quality in the three of the most polluted cities. The experience was provided by walking or gasping my way through a series of interconnected pods in which the pollution experienced in the cities was provided through a system of hoofers. Well, I don't know the technical word, but anyway, they blew contaminated air into the atmosphere in each of the pods. Now, the air, which you could almost cut with a knife, had been created by a parfumier and replicated fumes caused by vehicles, factories and chemicals which people breathe in every day. And the installation was created by Michael Penske, the artist who, located in the beautiful surroundings of Portland Stadium Bowl, erected the pots. And it was all done at the invitation of B-Side. So, taking a deep breath of fresh air, I began my tour, the pod that replicated the air that we breathe in central London. My guide this afternoon is David Buckland. Now, he's going to take me through several pods which actually replicate the air quality that you would expect to find in a number of cities. Now, what's the first pod we've been to?
The first pod we're standing at the moment is London. London is a major city in the planet. It is also quite polluted, which is a direct effect on people's health. And the air that you're experiencing in the first geodesic dome is the air that's replicated from London.
Right, well, it actually takes me back a bit, but you're absolutely right. There is a, I suppose you could say, a smell in the air. And funnily enough, I could feel it on my teeth, which is most peculiar. Oh, my goodness me. This is like a pea super.
Yes. We are now in New Delhi. New Delhi is the most polluted city on the planet. There are probably 26 million people living in the city. The humidity, the temperature that we're standing in right now, as you said, you can feel the sweat almost dripping off our skins, that the air that's coming out is almost unbreathable. It's really shocking. But you have to remember that 26 million people live in air. like this.
Now, it is like walking into a mist. I do not exaggerate. The sort of mist that would come off the sea in Portland on a very still day. And it stinks. It really does. Oh, find me somewhere else. Which city are we going to now?
We're
going to
go into Beijing, which is very famously a polluted city, but I think you'll find it a little more pleasant than where we've just been.
This sounds like a cook's tour of the nasty climate conditions. Yes, you're right. It's very different. There is still a mist in the air, and there's a very strange sort of flavour as well. It's sort of chemically somehow.
Yeah, I mean, what the artist Michael has tried to do is to replicate exactly the air from each of the cities, as you can see. That was the machine in the background throwing out even more pollution. But the airs that we've made are replications. They're not the actual polluted air of these cities. They're made with the perfumier from Paris, and who's actually taken the smells of the city and tried to replicate them. So oddly enough, they're not dangerous to our health like the original in the cities.
But so the humidity is so high, I could do with that perfumier making an antiperspirant, I think. So now I'm into
walk into São Paulo, which is again another huge city on our planet, again polluted. Although it's not quite as present in you, you wouldn't want to stay in this dome very long, would you? I don't think.
The humidity is incredible still, isn't it?
The humidity is up, and also there's a completely different flavour, it's completely different taste. That can you recognise it? I don't know. Does it reflect on anything?
Very difficult, actually, because, having been through three domes, it's difficult when you get to the fourth to actually pick up on what it is. It's not pleasant. I don't think you'd want to go to bed, smelling this sort of pollution. And I mean, have you picked very bad examples of the air, or is it just sort of random from the various cities?
The air, this is the dominant air. So with London, where we started, the big pollutant is diesel cars. But as you go through to Beijing, then you're dealing with sulfurs that are emitted from factories nearby. So each one, Michael can talk to you more about how and what and how they took the air. But this is the air that the inhabitants have to live in for most of the city over the year. So it is not pleasant.
I mean, on reflection, yes, I have got a hooter full of sulfur. I don't know which city was responsible. And I've certainly got a very strange, gritty taste in the mouth and the throat. Yes. I mean, I do feel it.
Yes, the more you, as you said, you would not like to sleep in this atmosphere. It does, and we've only been in it, 3 minutes? But already it's beginning to pick up. We are aware of our throats and aware of our lungs not being in a great place.
I mean, I don't want to be disgusting, but I feel as though I should have a good spit.
Let's go into the pure air of Norway.
The pure air of Norway. And I was there last month, actually, and the air is pure. Oh, what a relief. Right, let's go and talk to the artist who put this together. Michael Pinsky, you are an installation artist. Tell me, what gave you the idea for creating these 5 geodesic domes which replicate the dreadful air conditioning, or dreadful condition of air, in most cities in the world?
I've done a lot of work around climate change in the past, and I did a piece in Paris that focused on climate change, and this was seen by a group of Norwegian environmental psychologists, and they wanted to study whether art can really change people's perception of climate change. So they asked me to do a piece that they could study in more depth, and I went up to Norway and I was really stunned by the quality of the air there. And I thought that dealing with these differences of air quality could be an interesting way to engage people in climate change. And I thought about my life in London and how polluted the air is in London. And I thought, well, if I could then create these different pollutions, I could somehow talk about this issue directly in a more visceral way than through people reading about it. I was interested in creating these environments that people could experience with their bodies. So that's how I came up with this idea of having these five domes with these different types of pollution from around the world.
Now, Portland isn't the only place you've taken these geodesic domes. Where else have you been?
These have so far been in Norway, London, Geneva, Germany and Vancouver. And then after, and Manchester. And then after they're here, they're going to go to Australia, then New York, then Brussels and then Bratislava. Yeah, so there's quite a journey for these.
So it's quite a roadshow. What do you hope to achieve? I mean, other than bringing home to people in the most, auditory way, what do you hope to achieve?
I really want people to think about their lifestyles and what they can do to reduce consumption and therefore pollution. People just assume that they're going to buy a car and drive everywhere, and this is not sustainable in the future. So if I can make people think about what kind of different futures we may have if we carry on what business as normal, let's say business as usual, then if I can draw their attention to that, then I think that would be important, important outcome for the installation.
And do you travel with the show wherever it goes?
Yeah, I do try to. Yeah, I've been there everywhere so far.
Right. And what sort of comments have people made to you? And let's think about young people, because they are going to be those, well, they're going to be most affected if we don't do something about climate.
Well, I think it's particularly pertinent for children to come around, because a lot of children will assume as they grow up they need to learn how to drive and they'll get a car and they'll be part of this society of consumerism. And if they can start a question that at a young age and change your aspirations, then we've got some hope in the future.
And what has been the reaction of not only the public, but let's call them the opinion formers in various countries and various cities where you've taken this show? And by opinion formers, I suppose I mean politicians, people on councils, you know, people who are whose reactions are usually made public in the press.
It's hard to say yet. I mean, some of them have been around. I mean, I'm hoping this is going to go to New York and be part of the UN climate summit. So they will be big decision makers there. It's hard to know yet whether it will change your opinion or not.
Have you attracted any prime ministers yet?
Not yet.
But presidents?
I'm working on it.
All right. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay.
Well now, from polluted cities to flying to the moon, the Knowth Fort, which overlooks Portland and Weymouth, is celebrating the 50th anniversary of man's first moon landing in fine style. On July the 12th, 13th and 14th, the much-acclaimed Museum of the Moon sculpture will be hanging in the sky above the beautifully restored Victorian fort. Measuring 7 metres in diameter, it's a sculpture which includes lunar visuals, surround sound, and is a huge glowing orb that features detailed NASA imagery. Now, this fascinating fact is for the technical folk among our listeners. At a scale of 1 to 500,000, each centimetre of the sculpture represents 5 kilometres of the moon's surface. If any more explanation were needed, here's Stephen Booth of the Knowth Fort to tell us more.
We're going to be getting a cultural treat at the Knowth Fort, and it's called Museum of the Moon. It's a sculpture, but I need more information than that, so put some light on the activity.
Well, this Museum of the Moon, as you put it, is a replica of the moon, and it's incredible detail of the lunar surface. And this is going to be put into Knowth Fort and suspended by a crane and anchored down. And it's going to have all sorts of cultural events beneath it. Now, the reason this is here, or the reason why it's here in Dorset, because it's at two other locations, is because it's the 50th anniversary of the first landing of the moon with Neil Armstrong. So this is what it coincides with. and it's going to be with us for 3 days, from 1 p.m. to midnight, giving plenty of time for people to come. I think it will be more popular when it's dark, because this is why we're running till midnight, so that this is illuminated. It's got great detail. The atmosphere will be fantastic. And we're going to have all these different events, including dance, including singing, including silent disco, and many, many artists performing during the period that the moon is on display.
I've often prayed for a silent disco, but never mind. Now, how big is this? You say it's going to be suspended from a crane. I mean, try and give me a picture if you possibly can.
Well, the moon is 7 meters in diameter, so that gives you an idea of the size of it. And it's something that needs to be suspended. It needs to be in place. We hope that the wind isn't too high, because if it is, it causes a problem logistically. But it's such a wonderful backdrop, and there's going to be lots of projection on the walls as well. I mean, we had a display sometime many years ago. Some people may remember that B-Side Arts Organisation organised, and it was all projected onto the walls of Noth Fort, and we had actually the real moon over the ramparts in the background, and it was a wonderful, wonderful spectacle. And I think that's one of the reasons why this organisation, because it's B-Side Inside Out Dorset and also Bournemouth Arts by the Sea, it's these art organisations that have put this together. And this is the also funding from the Arts Council England. This is how it's come about. But this is something that's a one-off. It's a bit like when the Olympic Games came to Noth Fort in 2012. You won't see it again. It's a one-off. People really need to make the effort to come up and see this and enjoy the atmosphere, enjoy the music, enjoy the culture, the arts, and the performances that they will see during this time.
Now, let's get a little bit of technical detail on this. There's a scale of 1 to 500,000 centimetres, and each of those centimetres actually represents 5 kilometres of the moon's surface. Now, if you understand that, you're a better man than me. But nevertheless, this is a big installation, as Steve has just said. It's 7 metres in diameter. How are you going to display it?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, it's going to be suspended by a crane. It's going to have cables to anchor it down. It will be erected each day, and it will be taken down at the end of the session, which is midnight. It can't be left overnight because of possible weather changes. So it kind of goes to bed, just like the real moon does, so to speak, and it will be put out each day. I mean, this is something that Luc Jeremd, international acclaimed artist who developed this, and it has been displayed in China, the USA, and many other places around the world. So this is something that has a big draw. They know from previous experience, and I think Dorset is very fortunate to get this Museum of the Moon on display in 3 wonderful locations. And what's more, as I said earlier, it coincides with the first moon landing. We've got it on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, which I think is great.
And is there an admission cost?
Not at all. We want as many people as possible to be able to come up during the time that it's open. It's free admission. We're advertising it a lot. It's being advertised by many different organisations as well. It's in the media. It's on the website. It's on social media. And it's from the 12th of July, from 1 o'clock to midnight, and on the Saturday, the 13th, the same time, and Sunday also till midnight. So there's plenty of time for people to come along and see this.
So it's one step for mankind, but mankind must make steps to the Noth Fort on the weekend. Thank you so much.
Well, that, of course, was all about the appearance of the Museum of the Moon at the Noth Fort. But we must remember that it is on a tour, of course, in Dorset. Jenny Devitt has already covered it in her local world programme here on Keep 106, all about the Sherborne visit. But we must remember that those of us in Dorchester will be particularly interested that a week after the Noth Fort, the moon will be appearing at Mornbury Rings here in Dorchester, which will be renamed Moonbury Rings for the occasion. The weekend is the 19th to the 21st of July and includes all sorts of other stuff, including a huge concert by local school children singing specially composed music for the occasion. Moonbury Rings, as I say, it's called, the 19th to the 21st of July. And if you go to this website, there are lots more details on there. It's moonburyrings.co.uk. That link is also on the Keep 106 website as well, if you want to go along to there and have a look. Moonbury Rings, 19th to the 21st of July. Now, D-Day has been a well-aired subject over the past month, not least on Ridgeway Magazine, on which we've aired two special programmes. When John was in Normandy in April visiting the D-Day beaches, he took the opportunity of talking to General Lord Dannett, former chief of the British Army, who was conducting the party. Lord Dannett was a founder of Help for Heroes, whose collecting tins you cannot fail to have noticed. This is the story of the beginnings of the charity.
Lord Dannett, you were fundamental in setting up Help for Heroes. How long has it been going?
Help for Heroes was launched in our flat on the 1st of October 2007.
In your flat?
In our flat. It wasn't any old flat. It was actually the flat that I occupied, the apartment I occupied, as Chief of the General Staff in Kensington Palace. But the fact remains, 30 to 40 people gathered that evening, and Bryn and Emma Parry and Philip and my wife and I and Richard and Sarah Jane Sheriff were the six of us that started Help for Heroes. Now, the genesis of it was that Bryn and Emma Parry had been to visit the hospital at Selly Oak, where our badly wounded soldiers were taken to for clinical care. Their clinical treatment was very good, but the environment of that hospital and the organisation of that hospital was frankly pretty dire as far as our soldiers were concerned. As happens in any NHS hospital, patients were just scattered around wherever there was a bed. We all knew that soldiers needed to be grouped together so that they could, having fought together, they could recover together. So there were many issues that had to be dealt with. At the same time, my wife and I had visited the rehabilitation centre at Headley Court. And going round the site, the commanding officer had said to my wife, well, the one thing I need here is a swimming pool, but the Ministry of Defence, I know, will never pay for it. So we came away thinking they need a swimming pool. And Bryn and Emma Parry came away from Selly Oak thinking, we've got to do something. It's just not right what's going on there. The third couple involved, Richard and Sarah Jane Sheriff, who knew me well and knew Bryn and Emma well, said, can you both couples come for lunch one day and let's see what can be done? And around their dining room table, when Richard was commanding 3rd Division at Clive House in Tidworth, we said, well, look, there's obviously an enthusiasm to do something. They need a swimming pool at Headley Court. Let's form a charity, raise a bit of money, put that swimming pool at Headley Court, and then we'll carry on with our lives. And that conversation took place in early July 2007. Bryn got on with registering a charity. As a brilliant cartoonist, he produced some of the very attractive cartoon images, which really fired the public's imagination, and we launched the charity on the 1st of October 2007.
Who came up with the name Help for Heroes? Where did that come from? Because it's quite emotive.
Bryn came up with the name Help for Heroes, and it fitted his cartoonists. And Bryn had been in the army himself. He'd been the captain in the Royal Green Jackets, and his father had died while he was in the army. So Bryn actually knew some of the pain of all this. And Emma's family were very closely involved with the military as well. So this was something that was very, very close to their heart. Help for Heroes was a brilliant name. Not everyone thinks they're heroes, but we just put that to one side, but Help for Heroes is a great name, and then you ally that to some of Bryn's brilliant cartoons. The thing kicked off very quickly after the 1st of October 2007, and the money that we needed to raise for the swimming pool came in pretty quickly, and we could not stop people raising money for Help for Heroes very quickly. And within a matter of weeks, there were upwards of 2,000 events logged on our website that people were doing, whether it was running a marathon, whether it was baking a cake, whether it was climbing a mountain. People were just wanting to do something for our blokes. And I've often spoken of a sea change of attitude amongst the British public, but it happened in summer, autumn 2007, when suddenly people who didn't like what was happening in Iraq, didn't understand what was beginning to happen in Afghanistan, but did begin to appreciate the efforts of our soldiers, sailors, airmen and marines, and the sacrifices of their families, and wanted to do something. And it was an uncontrollable force, if you like, that became Help for Heroes. And although the other charities complained to start with, history will relate that actually the generosity of the British public wasn't just focused on Help for Heroes, it was focused on the other charities as well, and they all saw a surge in giving to their charities, and therefore an increase in the capability that they could offer to our wounded, injured and sick soldiers and their families.
Can we remind ourselves of some of the activities and some of the places and opportunities that Help for Heroes has given the... Can we just remind ourselves of some of the activities and some of the benefits that Help for Heroes has provided?
Well, as I mentioned just now, in the early days, Help for Heroes did not have to go fundraising. People in the up and down the country got it and gave freely of their own generosity because they saw the motivation and the need. The big flagship event that Help for Heroes organised early on and has run every year since then is the big battlefield bike ride, when hundreds of bicyclists under the Help for Heroes banner have visited one or other of the World War I or World War II battlefield sites in France, Belgium, Normandy, and that's been a very lucrative fundraising event. And there have been other big events, whether it's big rugby match at Twickenham or big cricket match at the Oval. But by and large, in the early days, Help for Heroes did not have to raise money. It came flooding in. What that meant that we were able to do was to look at the whole recovery pathway and say, when one of our young people is badly injured, they go to a hospital in Birmingham. A rebuilt hospital, the Queen Elizabeth Hospital now, is a state-of-the-art and wonderful hospital. That's where they go for the necessary clinical work. Then rehabilitation takes place at Headley Court, which has just moved to Stamford Hall in the Midlands. But then in Help for Heroes, we identified that there needed to be a third stage of recovery, which was getting people either fit enough to go back to military work in a full sort of sense, or accepting because they've lost limbs they were going to have to leave the armed forces and start another career, another useful career in civilian life. So we put recovery centres in place in Catterick in North Yorkshire, in Colchester, Tedworth House on Salisbury Plain, and in Plymouth. And those four recovery centres are one of the principal legacies of Help for Heroes. They're widely used by veterans, by families, and by the military as this third stage of recovery. Birmingham, Headley Court as it was, and now the recovery centres. And that's a really important part of what we do, as well as making grants to individuals, supporting what we call the Band of Brothers, the Band of Sisters, those who've been affected particularly by operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also more widely now, to make sure that we're looking after them. But here's a really critical point. A lot of those young people who lost limbs had state-of-the-art surgery, were given state-of-the-art prosthetic limbs, and have done really, really well. We've seen them trekking to the North Pole and climbing mountains, all that kind of stuff. But many of them are coming round again to need another round of surgery, as frankly the rest of their bodies can't stand up for all the pressure that life is imposing on them. So we know that we have to continue to look after the cohort from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's pretty large, both those who suffered physical injuries and those who suffered mental injuries. But also not forgetting we have a wider responsibility to those from the Falklands, to those from Northern Ireland, and from those and the Balkans as well, from other campaigns that we've been involved in. So our work is not done. Our work will never be done. And Help for Heroes is now pledged to support in exactly the same way we gave support in 2007-8-9, to continue to do it in 2019-2020 and be there in 2050. But we need to keep that need in front of the general public's eyes, because although the shooting might have stopped, the suffering hasn't. And the donations we absolutely need to keep flowing in so we can go on delivering the help that our young men and women so desperately need.
Lord Dallet, thank you very much indeed for talking to Keep 106.
Now, in past editions of Ridgeway magazine, we broadcast news and views about the imposition of the new unitary authority on the people of Dorset, in which five local councils became one. We were promised savings of £108 million in the first 6 years, greater efficiency, fewer councillors, improved services, as five became one. Well, it's been 3 months, so John went to talk to Jane Biscom, clerk of Weymouth Town Council, which is a much reduced version of the old Weymouth and Portland Borough Council. His mission was to ask about the first 100 days. How are things settling down?
Well, now, I can remember back in April voicing a lot of misgiving about the new county council which Weymouth was to join, the new unitary authority. Now, Jane, it's been 100 days since the parties got together. Now, was it a happy marriage or was it a rather sad divorce?
I'm not sure it was either. It was something completely bespoke to meet the needs, particularly of the people in Weymouth. So I wouldn't say it was a divorce because there's no animosity, there was no big arguments or fights, there was no splitting as such. It was a complete reorganisation. So what we had was Dorset County Council, Weymouth and Portland Borough Council, West Dorset, other agencies all coming together to put everything in a single pot and then split that out between the new Weymouth Town Council and the new Dorset Unitary Council. So we're working in harmony with Dorset. It's not a big fight. We're not at war. We're working very closely with them. The assets have been split. The Town Council's taken on those elements that Town Councils are best at. The recreation, the sport, the leisure. So the beach we have, parks and gardens, the promenade. So we've taken on those elements that we know are really important to people in Weymouth, and Dorset Council have taken on those elements that a unitary council normally takes on.
Now, there's a rather feeling, actually, that the new unitary authority had rather snaffled the crown jewels from Weymouth, and I can remember us, you and I, talking about this. I mean, is that a fact? I mean, let's talk about the pavilion site, shall we? I mean, what's happening about that? I remember 2 years ago, talk was of £14 million being spent on developing that site as a leisure complex. Now, where are we with that? Because that was a Weymouth Council project, wasn't it?
It was, and that's transferred up to Dorset Council. They are the harbour authority. As a town council, we can't be flood defence authorities or harbour authorities, so that had to go to Dorset Council. And it's such a massive project that we, as although we're one of the largest town councils in the country, we still are only a town council, very locally focused. And so that project has gone to Dorset Council. And as I understand it, outline planning permission has been granted. We're still awaiting the detailed planning application that will say exactly what's going where. And also, as I understand it, that is just on hold for a little while until the issues with the harbour wall are sorted. Obviously, you can't go building when there are issues with the harbour wall.
Tell me about the harbour wall, because listeners may not understand.
Okay, so some of the harbour walls are in need of repair, just to make sure that they've got a good long life and a fit for purpose and protect the town and protect the harbour itself. I understand that's all going forward in the summer, but Dorset Council, again, are leading on that work as the harbour authority.
So when do you think we might get some pretty pictures of what's going to go on that site?
Oh, I'm afraid I can't comment on that because it's not a project we're leading on. You need to ask Dorset Council on that, I'm afraid.
Well, I most certainly will.
I'm sure you will.
Now, other things that concern people. I mean, how much money is Weymouth actually going to get out of this marriage? Because there was a thought that the new unitary authority had sort of left Weymouth with very little income.
Well, it's kind of the way it works across the country, in that those assets that make money tend to sit with boroughs and districts, county councils, unitary councils, because it's those councils that have the really difficult, expensive jobs like schools, highways, adult social care, looked after children. It costs an awful lot more money to run those councils than it does a parish and town council.
But then if you think about it, I mean, Weymouth and Portland Borough Council owned a lot of real estate in the town, didn't they? I can't remember how many, but it was a lot of bed and breakfasts and hotels. I mean, what's happened to those?
So they've all gone to Dorset Council. Now, regardless of where the assets sit between the two councils, there is only a finite amount of money coming in. So if money-making assets were transferred to the town council, that would reduce the need for funding via council tax for the town council, but it would increase the need of funding from Dorset Council in the council tax. So there's only a finite pot of money, and no matter which way you split it between Dorset Council and the town council, the shortfall has to come from the council tax, regardless of which particular proportion, the amount of money stay the same.
But Weymouth hasn't done very well out of that, has it? Because our council tax is very high. In fact, I seem to remember that the unitary authority gave a figure. I think it's like savings will be £108 million over the course of the next so many years. I haven't seen any examples of that. My council tax has gone up.
Yeah, I've not had the figures off Dorset Council. Obviously, their finances are their business, but I'm sure in the fullness of time we'll be able to assess that. It'll take a few years to settle down. Certainly, for residents of Weymouth, you've never had a town or a parish council before, so you haven't had to pay that proportion of a parish and town council precept. Other areas in Dorset have. I think it would have been very unfair to not have a town council, because then you would have had no truly locally focused council. You would have had Dorset Council doing everything, whereas Blandford has Dorset Council and a town council, Shaftesbury has a town council, Dorchester has a town council, Bridport has a town council, Chickerell has a town council, Portland has a town council. Everywhere else in Dorset has a town council.
Oh, don't, no more. We'll run out.
I'm not listening everywhere.
We'll run out of time. But that brings me to another question, actually. Here we have an enormous county council. How many members are there on the county council?
So on Dorset Unitary Council, I believe it's either 82 or 84.
Now, what sort of share of voice does Weymouth and Portland have among that number?
So we are really, really lucky in Weymouth Town Council. We've got 29 great town councillors elected in May, and eight of those are also Dorset Unitary councillors. So we call those double hatters. So we have eight members who are really well plugged into what's going on up in Dorchester as well. Now, there's 163 parish and town councils in Dorset. We're just one of those. So to have that number of members who are also Dorset councillors means we're in a really good position to be plugged into all the work that's going on, have our voice heard, have those lines of communication open, and get some real partnership working going.
Now, I can't let you off the hook unless I ask you a question about lighting. What on earth is happening about lighting? Can we say nothing or something?
Oh, gosh, no, something is definitely happening. So I'm not sure when this will be going out.
It'll be going out in a few days' time. Why, is there going to be a development that I can catch up on?
There will be, and I can let you know in time to have something to tell all your listeners about, because on Wednesday, the 26th of June, there will be, because that's tonight as we talk, a full council meeting, and there's an item on the seafront lighting scheme there. The papers are all available on our website if anyone would like to read them. The Town Council is being asked to contribute £5,000 towards the scheme. And my understanding is that that scheme needs to happen before December. So if tonight the councillors agree that £5,000, the scheme will be going forward. And within our papers are links to a couple of YouTube videos, so your listeners can have a look and see what the plans are.
Right, so that's something to look forward to. What are the figures behind the lighting? Because I know that there was a shortfall, which nobody really wanted to talk about, but I suppose it's out in the open now, because the coastal people have been, shall we say, handing out the baking bowl. They need more money. What was the situation then? How much do they need?
So I'm more than happy to talk about these figures. We believe in open, transparent government, so we're happy to talk about that. And it's in our committee report, so I know Dorset Council and the Dorset Coast Forum are also happy to talk about these, and Weymouth Bid. So there's a shortfall of £65,000.
That's after 240,000 had been voted for the project.
Yeah, so there was a grant from the Coastal Community Fund that hasn't quite been enough to enable the project to go ahead. So there's a £65,000 shortfall. The town council are being asked to contribute £5,000. Weymouth Bid have kindly offered to contribute £5,000. Dorset Council have agreed £50,000, and Dorset Coast Forum will provide the last £5,000. So if we should get agreement tonight, the scheme will be able to go ahead quite soon.
Right, we will check up on the progress of the committee meeting or full council meeting. Now, Jane, thank you very much indeed for telling us where we are with this new unitary authority. What's going to happen in the future?
So in the future, oh gosh, see, it's such an exciting time because we can take the town council's work in whichever direction the communities and the councillors want it to go in. So we're only a few months old, so we're still finding our feet with something, but I'm really proud that the staff team that have come over have continued operating the beach, the cemeteries, the allotments, the parks and gardens. So hopefully your listeners haven't noticed any negative changes or any gaps in service. And I'm really proud that we've been able to hit the ground running, keep things going, and now we're moving into a phase where we want to say, right, what do we want to do to improve things? How can we make this better? And we will be running a community consultation over the summer to ask your listeners and all the residents in Weymouth what they think we should be focusing on so we can have an informed plan and move forward doing what we all want to achieve, which is making Weymouth the best place it can be to live, visit, work in, or go to school in.
So ever onwards and upwards. Jane, you can put a date in your diary, actually. I shall be coming to see you on the 365th day. So thank you for joining us and telling us about the first 100 days.
News, views, and fascinating facts with Ridgeway Magazine on Wednesdays at 11.
Now then, from moon events to space, but that's the space in the home. Now, I have to confess that my blood froze when I was told by her that must be obeyed that the top right-hand drawer in the venerable chest of drawers in the master bedroom has been requisitioned. Your stuff, she said, will need another home. And then came the second order of the day. Another blood-freezing moment, which went something like this, and we need to declutter the garage. Oh, I know there's rather a lot of old, partly used tins of paint, but hands off those lengths of wood and the tins of nuts, bolts and screws, because everything comes in handy one day, although some people may say handy, even unto Judgment Day. So I was heartened, or depressed, not quite sure which, when I read a survey conducted by a company called Anglian Home Improvements on the amount of room women take up in the home. 2/3, they say. Now, a few years ago on Ridgeway Magazine, we broadcast a feature on man sheds, the space in a home which men can call their own, places where they can build model aeroplanes, tinker with gadgets, repair things, or just sit and read in peace.
Now, according to this survey, women claim significantly more territory in the home than men. How so, you ask? Point one, women's belongings take up twice as much room as men's. This, it is said, forces their partners to store their bits and pieces in the garden shed. Excuse me, how many homes have garden sheds, let alone gardens? Anyway, according to the respondents in the survey, men have just 3 drawers for their use in the bedroom, and 1 in 7 men have been granted just 1 drawer. It gets worse. Women are more likely to spring clean. That's a coded message for throwing out their partner's belongings before their own. And chaps, beware. That favourite pullover bought 20 years ago, together with the shirts with some wear still left in them, will disappear, as 1 in 6 women confess to throwing out old clothes, and, horror upon horror, clothes they feel do not suit their other halves. Be thankful you don't live in Glasgow, where a third of women there confess to secretly throwing out their menfolks' clothes. It's said a third of men have been forced to put their bits and pieces in the garden shed. Some have to keep their clothes in another room because their womenfolk have taken up all the available drawers and hanging space in the bedroom.
Now then, how's this for a job title? Tidiness Guru. Tidiness Guru Sarat Sailor is quoted in the Daily Mail as saying, and I quote, "Relationships are all about compromises. Women's shopping habits might be different to men's, and so women might need more space. Having said that, sharing a household means both sides should be happy with their places." Now, almost 80% of the 2,000 couples quizzed in the survey admitted to having rowed over storage space. 6% have even considered breaking up because their partner is so untidy. Now, sadly, the survey does not indicate whether it is the men or the women who are the least tidy. I know it who it is in my house, but I couldn't possibly say.
Oh, John, go on, tell us. No, all right. We'll leave it there.
She may be listening.
Yeah. Now then, change of subject. It's off to Poundbury Gardens for a lesson on growing roses. Rewarding, yes, but they're not the simplest plant to grow, as John found out when he talked to Richard Jenkins. He gave some very good advice, which the novice rose grower would do well to heed.
We're going to be talking about roses. I mean, everybody loves roses, but they're sort of easy, oblique, difficult to grow, aren't they? They've got their own special requirements.
They have. Roses in general aren't as... they're quite fussy plants sometimes. There are different types, which many people don't realise. So you can go from your carpet roses to your patio roses to your shrub roses and onto your climbers and ramblers. And beyond that, you've got specialised roses like David Austin, where the variety is vast, but the heights can differ quite dramatically. So... all in all, yes, they're not as simple as people think.
Let's just go through the various types of roses with a little bit more detail, can we? I mean, when you say carpet rose, you buy a carpet rose, what sort of area will it cover?
So it does depend on the variety, but an average for a carpet rose, it can go anywhere up to sort of 2 metres by a couple of feet in height, but spreads usually about 2 metres in general. But it does depend on the variety of carpet. Things like patios, generally they go up to about, they can get up to about 3 foot, but they can only get as little as 1.5 feet. You know, they can be quite... petite, but fantastic for containers. So it just gives you an option if you haven't got the space but you love roses, then containerized roses is an option and patio is probably the way forward.
And you've got climbers. I mean, silly question. Yeah. How high does a climbing rose climb?
Again, it does depend on the variety of climber, but it can range from as little as 5 to 6 foot. It can go as high up to 15 foot.
Because actually, I've got a couple of roses which are growing up through trees. So they've got the light at the height of the tree. Quite amazing. So now then, we've been to a shop and we've bought our rose. There is a real way that you should be planting your rose, and it's not that simple.
It's not always that simple, and you've also got to be careful what shop you buy them from. Some people see a cheaper form of rose from, say, Tesco's or other retail outlets. Got to be cautious. They usually 9 times out of 10 are very tender, so they're grown over in Holland usually, brought over here for a particular date. So Mother's Day, you'll see a lot of these roses in bud. Realistically, they shouldn't be out in bud or in flower. So they're a lot more tender. So my tip is to hold fire. Don't be tempted by these early flowering roses, because 9 times out of 10 they're not going to be very hardy at all.
But nevertheless, they must be sold in their hundreds of thousands. And in fact, I was given one, and it's drooped. I planted it, I think, properly. I've been treating it extremely well. It gets breakfast, lunch and dinner, you know, but it's drooped.
Yeah, so again, that's due to the hardiness. Nighttime temperatures do drop, and that's when they're not very happy. So the key is with them is to stick with them. You're doing all the right things in terms of feeding. It's not happy at the minute, but as soon as those roots develop, it will start to harden off, hopefully. And in a couple of years' time, you might notice a difference. But you get what you pay for. And these cheaper roses, they don't always succeed, unfortunately.
Okay, well, let's say that I've been to Poundbury Gardens and bought a super-duper rose. Let's say that I bought a rose which I'm going to put in the garden. I don't want a rambler. I just want a nice sort of rose which is going to give me blooms all the year round. Well, not all the year round, but all summer long. How should I plant it? There is a technique, isn't there?
There is. So having the right planting medium's always a good start. So for the ground, you'd be planting in a rose tree and shrub compost. These days, the composts are all stated and very specialised to each individual plant. So there is a rose tree and shrub compost that you would use. Also, there's a product that's been around for the last few years called Root Grow. Technical term is mycorrhizal fungi.
Is that a powder?
It is, yeah. It's sort of a powder. It doesn't actually stick to the plant. You've got to actually put the root ball itself around this product. It doesn't stick to the root ball. But at the same time, it needs to be in direct contact. So when it comes to planting, having this mycorrhizal fungi, this root grow powder, it is essential, I would say. It will establish your root ball 10 times quicker than it would do naturally left to its own devices. And it also gives the plant very unique structure straight away as well.
Now, the depth at which you plant your rose is very important, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah. So lots of growers have different ways. Some people go over the base of the node. Some people go under. I've always left the crown of the plant slightly above the pot. So when purchasing the plant, always follow suit to how the plant's planted in the actual container itself. So once going into ground, just replicate that, and you can't go too wrong. The professional growers tend to go a little bit higher with them, and that's almost a protection thing through the winter months.
But if you're planting a rose out in a bed, I think you have to dig down quite deep, don't you?
You do. So generally, roses come in sort of a 3 litre container. Little tip is to get that container and go 2 to 3 times the depth of that container, and if you can, in width as well, that's always helpful. In terms of planting, get rid of the current soil that you're planting the rose in, and use completely fresh rose tree and shrub compost.
Just a quick question about my lovely rose bush. It's got lots of blooms on it. Deadheading. What's the secret to that?
Good pair of scissors. or secateurs, I should say, being a horticulturalist. It really is that simple. So once the flower starts to go over, just go back, follow the stem back to the nearest node and just pinch them out. Unfortunately, with the rainfall that you can have in some summers, it does damage the flower heads, so you're doing it a lot more frequent. But it really is just as simple as pinching them back.
And do you cut them back to the first bud?
Yes, so you go down a node. The actual stem that the flower head's on isn't particularly big anyway, so you'll just go back to your main stem. So you'll have your leader stem, and then you'll have your structural stem, and then you'll have little stems just coming off, and there's the stems you prune back.
What if there is no break in the stem?
If there's no break in the stem itself, then go back a little bit further to the next node.
Thank you very much indeed for putting us in the picture. And thank you very much indeed for listening to Ridgeway Magazine. From me, John.
And from me, Andy. It's goodbye until next time. Goodbye.